Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Exodus chapter 7. I'm going to do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 25, and we will take a look at the first plague on Egypt, where the water of the Nile is turned to blood. Our context is this. In a previous chapter, Exodus 6, we see that God is promising a dejected Moses deliverance. He is saying, look, I know Pharaoh didn't let you go take the children of God out of Egypt when you asked him to. And now Pharaoh has responded to that by making the Hebrew slavery even more severe by taking their straw away and making them pick up their own straw. And now the people don't follow you anymore, Moses, and they think you're a bad leader because you've screwed them over. Well, God cheers Moses up and says, no, go back. Go back and we're going to show Pharaoh some stuff that's going to make him drive you out of Egypt. Not just let you go, but drive you out. So that's our context. Here we are at Exodus 7, verses 1 and 2. Then the Lord said to Moses, see, I make you as God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and your brother Aaron shall speak to Pharaoh that he let the sons of Israel go out of his land. Of course, Aaron's doing the speaking because Aaron is Moses' spokesman, as we know. Let's get the context of this, the last verse of chapter 6. But Moses replied in the Lord's presence, since I am such a poor speaker, how will Pharaoh listen to me? There were about four places where Moses expressed extreme reluctance to be the leader of the Hebrews, and this is one of them. And now God is trying to say, this is how you're going to do it. You're going to be a poor speaker? You worried about that? Well, Aaron's going to take care of it here. Aaron shall be your prophet. Now, when God says, I make you as God to Pharaoh, there's a couple of ways you could take that. You could take it this way. You could say, Moses, you can bring blessings on the land of Egypt, or you can bring plagues on the land of Egypt, just like God can. In other words, Moses, you speak a word and a plague comes. That's just like God. He speaks a word, there comes the plague. And Moses speaks another word and the plague is removed. That's one way of looking at it, but I think more likely it's this way. God is making an analogy, just as God speaks through his prophets, Moses will speak through Aaron. Moses tell Aaron what to say, and Aaron will say it. Just like God tells his prophets what to say, and the prophets say it. And the reason I say that is because of the last verse of Exodus 6. Moses has complained that he's such a poor speaker. How will Pharaoh listen to me? And this is God's answer. Aaron will be to you as I am to prophets. He'll speak. You speak to Aaron, and then Aaron will speak, and that'll take care of your poor speaking ability. We go now to Exodus chapter 7, verses 3 through 5. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart. Yahweh continues speaking to Moses. I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that I may multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. When Pharaoh does not listen to you, then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring out my host, my people, the sons of Israel, from the land of Egypt by great judgments. The Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst. Now God says in verse 3, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. I'm not going to go through this hardening Pharaoh's heart discussion every time we encounter harden in the text. I've already done that in the previous, I think it was chapter 5, excuse me, chapter 4. Basically what it is Pharaoh's, he hardened his own heart, and as a judicial punishment for that, God hardened Pharaoh's heart further. It's not that God takes a sweet and innocent Pharaoh and says, I'm not going to let you believe. I'm going to harden your heart so that you have no choice but to rebel against me. It's not that way at all. Pharaoh's heart was hard already when God hardened his heart. There are 9 times in Exodus where Pharaoh had his heart hardened by God, but there are also 9 times where he hardened his own heart, as I went through in my previous audio in chapter 4. I'm not going to do that again. This calls to mind what Paul said in Romans 1, 24 through 28. He's talking about homosexuality and homosexuals, and he says in verse 28, they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer. God gave them over to a depraved mind. So what happened first? The homosexuals didn't acknowledge God, and then God gave them over to depraved mind to do those things which are not proper, such as fisting and rimming and all the other wonderful stuff that the LGBTQ lifestyle advocates. Now note that God didn't harden Pharaoh's heart as regards eternal salvation, only in respect of letting the Hebrews go. Adam Clark, the Arminian, of course, would say that. Well, he's right, but so what? I mean, everybody's heart is hardened against salvation before they get saved. It takes irresistible grace to unharden it. So God here in verse 4 warns Moses, hey, don't get discouraged. He's not going to listen to you. but I want you to tell him anyway, let my people go. And by the way, in the last chapter, it was not ask him, but tell him. Tell Pharaoh, let my people go. We go now to Exodus chapter 7, verses 6 and 7. So Moses and Aaron did it as the Lord commanded them. Thus they did. Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh. Moses had spent 40 years in splendor in the Egyptian court, and then he spent 40 years in the wilderness in Midian. And of course, his power came after he was in the wilderness for 40 years in Midian. Good application point there is, you want to do something with your natural abilities and your riches and your splendor and your intellect and your learning and all that stuff and your political power, you ain't going to do nothing. But after you get banished into the wilderness and nobody's listening to you for 40 years, that's when God's power is going to start moving. That's the way God does things. Now, the first thing we want to ask is, why is Moses and Aaron's age mentioned here? Well, here's a couple of options. John Gill says it was to show how long Israel had been afflicted in Egypt. Remember, when Moses was born, the Hebrews were slaves, and he's 80 years old, so that's at least 80 years old they've been afflicted by slavery. Another possible reason why the age is mentioned here is given by Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. According to them, it's to show how miraculous it was for an old man to lead a whole nation from slavery. Think about that, 80 years old and you're leading a couple million people through the desert. I mean, you remember Charlton Heston, you know, and the Ten Commandments? He had gray in his hair, did he not? It didn't look like he was 80 years old, but he did look sort of old. John Gill points out that no other prophets in the Old Testament spoke in their old age. Only Moses and Aaron did. And by the way, Sister Miriam, she was the older sister. She was older than either Moses or Aaron, as Clark says. I don't know how Clark knows that. It's probably in the scripture somewhere, and I just hadn't gotten there yet. Now, when Moses and Aaron did it, that means they went to the Pharaoh and said, let my people go, as the Lord commanded them. After they did that, they never showed any reluctance anymore. I've got what I call the four reluctances, one of which I've already mentioned to you, the last verse of chapter 6. Moses says, I can't go, I'm slow of tongue, I can't speak. When he was in Midian and God appeared to him in the burning bush, Moses says, but what if they ask me your name? I don't know what your name is. And then another place he just says, why don't you send somebody else? He just didn't want to do it. I don't have the sites in front of me, but I'm speaking from memory, but there were four times that this happened. Well, after this, there's nothing but faith and power from now on. We go now to Exodus 7, verses 8 through 10. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, work a miracle, then you shall say to Aaron, take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent. So Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh, and thus they did just as the Lord had commanded. And Aaron threw his staff down before Pharaoh and his servants, and it became a serpent. Now this staff is probably the same rod that Moses had turned into a snake at Horeb when he was giving one of the three signs to the Hebrews, not to the Egyptians, but to the Hebrews. If you recall that was in Exodus 4, verses 2 through 4. The Lord said to Moses, what is that in your hand? And Moses said, a staff. And God said, throw it on the ground. So Moses threw it on the ground. It became a serpent. And Moses fled from it. But the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail. So he stretched out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. That staff shows up a lot. Now, some people debate whether Moses' staff is different than Aaron's staff. I don't think so. I think Aaron just grabbed the staff since he was Moses' spokesperson. That would be perfectly natural. And then Aaron used the staff sometimes too. I don't know why people get... I saw a whole internet article on that issue, which I thought was a little bit of overkill. So Aaron takes the staff, threw it down in front of Pharaoh. Now, there's a different Hebrew word that's used here for serpent. John Gill and Adam Clark say that some people translate that word as crocodile. So I love this. You throw the staff down and it becomes a crocodile? Wow. I don't know about that. Now you notice here in verse 9, this is sort of interesting. Pharaoh is going to challenge Moses and Aaron first. Pharaoh speaks to you saying, work a miracle. Then that's when you throw the staff down in front of Pharaoh. Now I don't know why Pharaoh would be asking for a miracle. I guess maybe he thought, well, let's just see how strong this Yahweh God is, the God of the Hebrews. I think we can take him. I think my magicians can do miracles better than they can. John Gill and Adam Clark say it was a natural request for Pharaoh to ask for a miracle, given the enormity of Moses' task. He's saying, come on, Moses, you want me to let 600,000 male Hebrews out into the wilderness, please, you might as well do a miracle for me to show that you have the authority to do that. And of course, Moses had the goods. He had the receipts. We go now to Exodus chapter 7, verses 11 through 13. Then Pharaoh also called for the wise men and the sorcerers. And they also, the magicians of Egypt, did the same with their secret arts. For each one threw down his staff, and they turned into serpents. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Yet Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had said. Now why did Pharaoh call in the magicians? Perhaps Pharaoh wanted to see if Aaron had just done a sleight-of-hand magic trick, or whether it was an actual miraculous work of Yahweh. Or maybe Pharaoh knew that Aaron had done a work by Aaron's God Yahweh, a supernatural work, not a sleight of hand. He knew it was a miracle, but he said, well, let's see if my magicians can beat that miracle. I think we want to beat these Hebrew slaves, these despised shepherds. They can do a miracle. Well, my miracle's better than your miracle. Now, these sorcerers are not named in the text that Pharaoh called. He calls them wise men and sorcerers. That's because usually people that get into the occult, they always have a whole bunch of occult lore that goes with it. Abracadabra charms and potions and spells and all this kind of stuff. And so you have to be wise in order to handle all that. So I'm assuming that wise men and sorcerers are just two different names for the same group of people. And who were these people are actually named in 2 Timothy 3:8. Paul says to Timothy, just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, so also certain heretics that Paul's worried about in 2 Timothy, they are rejected in regard to the faith. So Jannes and Jambres are given a name by Paul. That's probably because the names were passed down in Jewish tradition, just not recorded by Moses, but Jewish tradition had it, and Paul knew the Jewish tradition since he was raised so deeply in the Hebrew faith. The name Jannes is actually mentioned in the Dead Sea Scrolls, so we're going to call these two magicians Jannes and Jambres from now on. Now, they turn their snakes into their staffs into snakes using their secret arts. Now, there is a debate amongst commentators as to how did they do this. Was it sleight of hand, a magic trick, or was it demonic powers that turned those staffs into snakes? Now, Rich Deem, Reasons to Believe, I think is the name of his website. He's an old earther, but he also does apologetics. He just says it's demonic powers, and that's reasonable. But other people say that the magicians, Jannes and Jambres, used sleight of hand. NIV Study Bible suggests that. NIV Study Bible gives both options, demonic powers or sleight of hand. John Gill says it was sleight of hand. Now, let me give you a quote from Jameson Fawcett Brown about this. Quote, the magicians of Egypt in modern times have long, now modern times, of course, is 19th century, when Jameson Fawcett Brown were writing, the magicians of Egypt in modern times have long been celebrated adepts in charming serpents, and particularly by pressing the nape of the neck, they throw them into a kind of catalepsy, which renders them stiff and immovable, thus seeming to change them into a rod. They conceal the serpent about their person, and by acts of legerdemain, that sleight of hand, produce it from their dress, stiff and straight as a rod. Just the same trick was played off by their ancient predecessors. And so it appears they succeeded by their quote-unquote enchantments in practicing an illusion on the senses. Let me give you a more modern quote. 1999, this is from apologeticspress.org. Quote, Rod Robison, a comedy magician from Tucson, wrote, quote, turning a rod into a snake, for instance, is easily accomplished by the same method modern-day magicians turn a cane into a flower or handkerchief. I've seen the cane-to-snake performed by magician Alan Roscoe. Believe me, it's impressive. Well, if people are still doing that trick, maybe the Pharaoh people did it also. But maybe it was demonic, too. Who knows? Everything God does, the devils try to imitate. Trouble is their imitations are pale copies of true miracles that Yahweh produces. Now we see Aaron's staff swallowing up Jannes and Jambres' staff. Well, first of all, is it staff swallowing up staff? It's probably snake swallowing up snake. It's more precisely, it would be the snake doing it, even though staff is mentioned in the text. That's because it started out being a staff, but I assume it's after they were snakes. Aaron's snake swallowed up Jannes and Jambres' snake, and the symbolism there is pretty obvious. That shows that God is master over the demons, over Egypt, over the Egyptian magicians. We go now to Exodus 7, verses 14 and 15. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is stubborn. He refuses to let the people go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he is going out to the water, and station yourself to meet him on the bank of the Nile. And you shall take in your hand the staff that was turned into a serpent. Now, why did Pharaoh go to the water in the morning? Here's some options. He could have just been taking a morning walk like he normally did. John Gill suggests that. Option number two, perhaps he wanted to observe divinations on the water as his wise men and magicians did their hocus pocus, pouring their water in and out and doing their ablutions and all that kind of stuff, worshiping the Nile River, which of course was the source of all life to Egyptians. Well, if that's what Pharaoh was doing, that was a perfect time to confront him, because Moses is saying, I don't care about your Nile God. My God's greater than yours. Option number three, Pharaoh could have gone to the river to see how much the river had ascended, because that would determine prosperity for the next year. That would be sort of a formal trip down to the river. Or option number four, maybe he was going down there to take a bath. Adam Clark said, well, for whatever reason, he was down there going to the water. It's interesting to me how Moses is able to get close. Moses and Aaron is able to get close to the big shots in the Egyptian government. I mean, the number one guy in all of Egypt. I suspect it's because people knew by then that Moses was speaking for all the Hebrew slaves, and so he had some clout behind him, not as far as the slaves' status, but as far as their numbers were concerned. Pharaoh was worried about those numbers, so naturally he'd want to speak to Moses and Aaron. Not to negotiate, but to tell them things. Now in verse 15, God tells Moses to take the staff that was turned into a serpent, that same staff. I'm assuming it's the same staff, Moses' staff, Aaron's staff. Why did God ask Moses to carry that to see Pharaoh? Well, perhaps to terrorize Pharaoh, because Pharaoh had already seen that staff eat up the magician's snakes. And so, this is a bad memory, another snake. We go now to another judgment of visitation. Another occasion for judgment brought about by that staff, that nasty staff. Exodus chapter 7, verses 16, 17, and 18. God continues, You shall say to him, Moses, The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, sent me to you, saying, Let my people go, that they may serve me in the wilderness. But behold, you have not listened until now. Thus says the Lord, By this you shall know that I am the Lord. Behold, I will strike the water that is in the Nile with the staff that is in my hand, and it will be turned to blood. The fish that are in the Nile will die, and the Nile will become foul, and the Egyptians will find difficulty in drinking water from the Nile. Now Moses is to ask the Pharaoh to let my people go to serve God in the wilderness. That would be at Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, in the southeastern corner of the Sinai Peninsula, in the land of Midian. That would be where they would go. But Pharaoh didn't listen, and so then God strikes the water into the Nile. The water that is in the Nile, he strikes it, and it turns into blood. Now, here's some options as to how the Nile turned into blood. Well, it could have been real blood, but I don't think so. Here's option number two. It could be a red sediment washed from Ethiopia. Remember, the Nile runs from Ethiopia, Nubia, down there in southern Egypt. It got lost in the wilderness down there. Actually, nobody for years knew where the head of the Nile was. And the Nile flowed from south to north and dumped into the Mediterranean Sea. Well, the Ethiopian desert down there, that red soil could have washed into the Nile, and so the Nile then carried it on up to the north. The Nile usually flooded in late summer, early fall is when the Nile floods usually occurred, and that red sediment could have come up and then just polluted all the water in the Nile. Now, this is a natural process, but it's a natural process done at a miraculous time. As soon as Moses said, boom, there it was, so it would still be a miracle. The NIV Study Bible says it's possible that the first nine plagues were a miraculous intensification of natural processes, and I'm willing to go along with that. There's another possible natural process that the NIV Study Bible mentions is a red algae could have polluted the Nile River. Now, red algae, that happens a lot of times in different bodies of water. You can look that up on the internet. It's poisonous, too, that red algae. So let's just go with the red algae option. I think that's more likely than sediment coming up from Ethiopia. This event was a big deal in Hebrew history. In Psalm 78:44, the psalmist says, God turned their rivers to blood, and their streams they could not drink. Psalms 105, verse 29. He, God, turned their waters into blood and caused their fish to die. Now, the Nile was the source of life to the Egyptians, so it was serious business for it to turn to blood. There were no fountains in Egypt. There was almost no rain in Egypt. There are no independent rivers. I mean, it's the Nile. That's it. That's where our water comes from. And now it's blood red, full of this stinking red algae. Now, the Nile is interesting. The Nile River's water was wonderful to taste. Let me read what Adam Clark says. Quote, "All those who have tasted of this water allow that they never met with the like in any other place. When a person drinks of it for the first time, he can scarcely be persuaded that it is not a water prepared by art, for it has something in it inexpressibly agreeable and pleasing to the taste, and it should have the same rank among waters that champagne has among wines. But its most valuable quality is that it is exceedingly salutary," that means healthy, promoting health. "It never incommodes, never inconveniences. Let it be drank in what quantity it may. This is so true that it is no uncommon thing to see some persons drink 3 buckets of it in a day without the least inconvenience." Oh, that makes me want to drink some Nile water right now. But it's gone now. It's red. "The Egyptians preferred the Nile to all the waters of the universe." So, that was a big deal, turning the pride and joy of Egypt into blood. That's a poke in the eye. Yahweh versus the demons, versus the Egyptian gods. We go down to chapter 7, verse 19 of Exodus. "Then the Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, take your staff and stretch out your hand over the waters of Egypt, over their rivers, over their streams, and over their pools, and over all their reservoirs of water, that they may become blood, and there will be blood throughout all the land of Egypt, both in vessels of wood and in vessels of stone." Again, Aaron is acting as Moses' spokesman, so he says, so Aaron took the staff, stretched it out over the waters of Egypt, over the Nile, and I'm sure he waved it around as he went, you know, over the streams, over the pools, that just means everywhere. Aaron took the rod and took it up in the air and swung it all over the compass, 180 degrees, maybe 360 degrees. Now, if the Nile was red silt from, if the blood in the Nile was red silt from Ethiopia, we would have to say that the Nile does not instantly become blood. It would take time for that sediment to gradually infiltrate all the water supply of Egypt. Now, the red algae might be a little bit faster, but I would think it would take some time to do that. But there's nothing here that talks about the timing of it. It just happened. Now, what became blood? Red blood? What water? The streams? That's probably the branches of the Nile, like the Pelusium branch, all those Nile branches up in the north. Over their pools, I'm not sure what that is, unless that's where it says reservoirs of water. That would be what the Egyptians stored their water in. Now, I'm going to make a point here in a minute. I'm not sure this means that the water that was already sitting in those reservoirs or those pools became blood. It was only after it was collected from the Nile that it became blood, I think. It doesn't really say. Now, the water is blood red in the vessels of wood and vessels of stone. That perhaps refers to filtering vessels, because the Nile was very muddy and it had to be filtered to drink through a paste made of white almonds, according to Adam Clark. And so I'd imagine the Egyptians tried to filter their water as usual, and unfortunately, there's red algae in there, and that algae couldn't be filtered, and the waters in the storage vessels became worthless, useless, and bloody red. Now, how long did this last? Well, as we see in verse 25, the blood plague on the Nile lasted 7 days. So the Egyptians had to go 7 days without water. Well, you know, people can't live 7 days without water. The whole country would have died. A lot of Egyptians probably did die, as John Gill says, but there were other ways that they could stay alive. Now, here's some options. These are mostly from John Gill. The Egyptians could have used the juice of fruit and herbs to stay alive. Richer folks may have had a stock of wine. That would keep you alive. Maybe they could strain the bloody water and make it drinkable. What I just said, that both in vessels of wood and vessels of stone, it doesn't sound like that water, you could strain that water and keep it drinkable. But maybe so. They could have dug down into the ground to well water. We see in verse 24, the text says, "All the Egyptians dug around the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink of the water of the Nile." So I guess that's possible. They could do that. It could be they probably had some water stored at the time of the calamity, because everybody keeps water on hand. And maybe they just rationed it and made it for 7 days. Again, that assumes that the stored water had not become blood. So I'm making a distinction there. If the water's already stored, it's all right. But if you go out to the Nile and try to filter it to get some more, the filtering is not going to work, and it's going to end up blood red again. But anyway, there's ways they could survive for 7 days. That's not a difficulty in the text or anything. It's a difficulty for the Egyptians. We go now to Exodus chapter 7, verse 20 through 21. So Moses and Aaron did even as the Lord had commanded, and he lifted up the staff and struck the water that was in the Nile, that would be Aaron, in the sight of Pharaoh, in the sight of his servants, and all the water that was in the Nile was turned to blood. Verse 19 was God saying to Moses, who was then to turn around and say to Aaron, stretch out the staff over the waters. That was just the oral instructions. And in verse 20, it's actually done, carried out. So Moses and Aaron did even as the Lord had commanded. And he, that's Aaron, lifted up the staff and struck the water that was in the Nile in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, and all the water that was in the Nile was turned to blood. The fish that were in the Nile died, and the Nile became foul, so that the Egyptians could not drink water from the Nile, and the blood was through all the land of Egypt. Now, I've been saying that the Nile was important to the Egyptians. It was so important that the Egyptians deified the Nile as the god Hopi. H-O-P-I, or Hopi, I'm not sure how you would pronounce that. So here, God was desecrating one of their most important national idols. Now, many people have pointed out, and we'll see this as we go through the plagues, that God deliberately picked on Egyptian gods and poked them in the eyes. He went plague by plague by plague. So we'll look at that. So this is the first Egyptian god that gets disrespected, that gets dissed by Yahweh, is Hopi. I'm going to pronounce that Hopi. Hopi ain't happy. Now, the fact that the river was turned to blood, that's a fitting judgment, appropriate. The Egyptians had thrown the Israelite babies in the Nile to kill them, and now the Hebrews are going to take the Nile and kill some Egyptians. Not all of them, but some of them. Now, the fact that fish died, in verse 21, the fish in the Nile died, that proves that the blood was not an optical illusion, because fish would not be affected by an optical illusion, as Gill and Clark point out. So whatever happened to the Nile, it was real. It didn't just look like it was red. Like the waters in that, when Jehoshaphat took all the singers and went down the army, I think he was allied with the northern king, that went down south of the Dead Sea and went up to Moab, and they were getting to attack, and it said in that passage somewhere that the waters in front of them looked like it was red. It was red as blood. That was when the king of Moab sacrificed his son on the wall, and for some reason that caused all the Israelites to withdraw. You know that story in the Old Testament. That water looked like it was blood. That was an optical illusion. The sun was probably bouncing off of it in the desert. But this was not an optical illusion. This was the real thing. We go now to Exodus chapter 7, verses 22 through 25, and we'll finish up this audio. But the Egyptians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts. The same means they took water and turned it into blood. We'll talk about how they did that in just a minute. But the magicians of Egypt did the same with their secret arts, and Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had said. Remember, God had already told Moses, he's not going to listen to you. Then Pharaoh turned and went into his house with no concern even for this. So all the Egyptians dug around the Nile for water to drink, for they could not drink of the water of the Nile. 7 days passed after the Lord had struck the Nile. That Pharaoh was one stubborn son of a gun. If my country was afflicted such that I couldn't get water for 7 days, I would show a little bit of concern about it. If Pharaoh just said, well, who cares, walked into the house, showed no concern. Now, the magicians of Egypt did the same. Well, it wasn't exactly the same. They didn't turn water all over Egypt into blood like Aaron had done with Moses' staff. Obviously, they couldn't do that because it already was blood. John Gill makes a little bit of a snarky remark. He said if they wanted to equal Moses and Aaron, Janus and Jambri should have turned all the blood back to water. But they didn't. Well, what did they do? Probably what they did is they took a pot of water and changed that one pot into blood, making it appear to be blood. Again, they would have to find some clear water somewhere. They could have gotten to an Israelite home. If you assume the Israelites are not afflicted by the plague, that's an assumption. It's not stated anywhere. It's an assumption that the Israelites were protected from the plagues, and so they went to the Israelites' home and said, okay, we can get some of your Israelite clean water, and we'll turn it into blood. They could have dug for the waters in verse 24, and I think that's probably what they did. They could have found a backwater. If the blood is spreading through Egypt gradually, the algae, they could have gone away from the Nile far enough away where they got some clean water. Or they could have, these are all John Gill's ideas, my ideas, they could have just gotten water that was stored before the plague, which had not been affected by the plague, only got water out of a stone pot somewhere in somebody's house, and then they turned it into blood. Now, how they did that, I don't know. How they made it red, I don't know. I wish I did, but I don't understand occult tricks very much, not being very experienced with it. Now in verse 22, once again, Pharaoh's heart was hardened again because he was rebellious against God, and he hardened his own heart, and then God hardened it even further. God does not take away his free will or his free moral choice. Pharaoh probably thought Moses and Aaron had done some sort of sorcerer's trick to get all of the water to turn red. This is according to Adam Gill. He had seen that many times, but I suspect he hadn't seen a trick as big as the one as Moses and Aaron did, turning all the water, but turning a little bit of the water red is one thing, but all the water? Now, what Pharaoh might have thought, this is my idea. He might have said, okay, Aaron and Moses, you turned the water into blood, but you know, this red algae, we've seen that before. It just happened to show up here when you stretched your staff out. Maybe that's why Pharaoh showed such little concern as he walked back into the house. He said, ah, this stuff has come before. It'll go away again. These Hebrews are just trying to make hay off a natural phenomenon that happens all the time. It was just a coincidence. The timing was a coincidence, when, of course, we know that it was not a coincidence. The timing was of God. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we finished chapter 7. That prepares us for our next audio, which is chapter 8. I'll do the entire chapter, verses 1 through 32. And we'll look at plagues number 2 through 4. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.